Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hey, everybody, before you hit fast forward, if you are listening right now on an iPhone, I need a quick favor. It's only going to take you 15 seconds, if you wouldn't mind. And you can do this without even pausing the show. Okay, grab your phone. Go to the podcast app that you're listening on right now. Swipe back to where you could see four icons on the bottom of the screen, right on the podcast app. One of those icons on the bottom of the screen will say library on it. Click library. And once you are in the library, everybody there, there should be a purple link right underneath the word library that says shows on it. Click on shows, and you will see all your shows there. Hit my thumbnail, Backseat Rider, and at this point, you should see my episodes, a sign that says my episodes. Scroll down through all those episodes, keep scrolling, and once you get to the bottom, you will see ratings and reviews. There's a space right underneath it that says tap to rate. I would love it if you tap that real quick. Give me a rating. We got thousands of downloads each week, everybody, but only about 200 people have left a rating. As of right now, there's about 230 ratings, and I would love to see that number spike by next week. You don't need to write anything if you don't want to. Just a 5-star rating would be much appreciated. So again, grab your phones, open the podcast app, hit library, and then the word shows. Scroll down. Ratings and reviews, and please give the show 5 stars if you wouldn't mind. It'll help reach more and more people. All right, before we get to this week's show, TrueCar is a company making it possible for me to bring you this show for free each week, and they give us some useful car tips you might not be aware of. For example, did you know a coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior? Removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. That one makes sense. And this one's kind of strange. You can place your key fob on your chin to increase its range. Well, here's another tip you might not know about. TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That is correct. TrueCar isn't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you will enjoy real pricing on actual inventory, and also a simpler buying process whether you are buying new or used. Also, with TrueCar, users can see what other people paid so they know if they're getting a good deal before buying. And they're also way more likely to enjoy a faster car buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. So when you are ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. And now to this week's episode. In case you didn't see the word E for explicit when you hit download or stream, this episode is explicit. It's not safe for work, not safe for kids, also not safe for anyone who isn't comfortable hearing some really inside stuff about drug addiction, and also some graphic depictions of sexual acts. So if that is you, or if you do have kids within an earshot, make sure they cannot hear.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
For those of you who have been with this podcast since its earliest days, you may recall me mentioning this mythical figure named Toth the News God. And Toth, in some storytelling circles, is known as this deity responsible for when you, as the storyteller, are going to be blessed with good content and good interviews that day. Some days, it's obvious that you have pissed off Toth because you get really dry, boring content. And then other days, Toth is definitely with you. And so with that said, for me, Tuesday, March 6th. It started out like any other Tuesday as a Lyft driver with a set of microphones, but soon That Tuesday revealed itself as a day when Toth the news god was going to be kind. So as you guys know, my whole goal on this show is to drive as many people as possible and then hopefully share real stories that are either entertaining or informing or enlightening in some way. And most of all, though, to remind all of you each week that we are all trying to get through, as the late Prince so eloquently phrased it, this thing called life. And this week, on the roads of Chicago, I encountered two people whose stories I hope will enlighten, even if they are uncomfortable to hear at points. And this first one is from a former model who tells the story of how an offer changed his life forever.
Hey, this is Crystal Meth. You want to try it? I'm like, okay. If that didn't happen, it might have happened sometime later. But it was an introduction to the drugs. And I said yes.
I was up in Rogers Park, that's on the far north side of Chicago. It was really dreary that Tuesday morning, and I just dropped off a passenger right near Northwestern University. Ride request came in from somebody named Anthony. This person didn't have a profile picture. And I was about a block and a half away from the pickup spot when the phone rang. And when the phone rang, it was this 415 number. That's the San Francisco area code. So I knew it was the passenger contacting me via the Lyft app. So when I picked up the phone, it was Anthony. But he said he had called Lyft that morning for somebody else, a friend of his or perhaps a family member of his who needed a ride to a major dental appointment. Those were his exact words, major dental appointment. So I told Anthony that I was about a block and a half away and that, well, technically I'm not supposed to drive anyone who doesn't have their own Lyft account and doesn't use their own Lyft account. I agreed to make the pickup and to give the ride. And at that point, Anthony told me to be on the lookout for a big guy who'd be waiting outside. So I pull up to this side street. We're only steps away from Lake Michigan, the lakefront, and I see a big guy smoking a cigarette. And we make the kind of eye contact that tells me he's definitely my passenger. And then I notice him kind of furiously trying to get a few last second drags in off the cigarette. And even as he's in the process of sitting down in the backseat of my car, he inhaled one last time before tossing the rest of the cigarette out in the street. And now, seconds after he had given me permission to record, his phone rang.
Hi, I got picked up. I'm on my way. All right, yeah, it is. All right. Yes, I'll talk to him about that. I will. All right, bye-bye.
Can't say it for sure, but my gut was telling me right there that the guy who called him was, once again, Anthony. Double-checking that my passenger was in the car, that he was on the way to the dentist, and he also had a couple last-minute reminders for him to be sure to ask the dentist. So to set the scene a little bit more, I'd put my passenger at about 6'2", 230. It's a heavyset guy, white man, who appeared to be in his 40s, possibly early 50s. And he had a full head of hair. It had been shaved down about to the scalp. And that day, which again was March 6th, I had been questioning my passengers about guns and gun control for possible use in an upcoming episode. And that is when the conversation took a turn.
Has your life ever been impacted by guns in any way?
I've had a gun held to my head in a situation where I put myself for a drug connection.
What happened?
It went sour. They were paranoid schizophrenic, and they pulled it out, and I just kind of got up and got out of there without him shooting me. I took a chance.
So, how long ago was that?
About 5 years ago.
Okay. And so, Was it an argument? So this guy was paranoid schizophrenic.
He thought I was an undercover cop. And I get that a lot when I'm on the train and when I'm out in public. People kind of look at me, and especially in the summer when I'm wearing my sunglasses and I'm dressed nice, I get that. Like, people ask me that, are you undercover? And I have nothing to do with the police.
I could see that. I mean, there's a stereotypical image of a big, tough cop. And it kind of looks like you. I mean, if I were casting a movie and I needed a Chicago police officer,
yeah,
I would consider casting you.
I see them, and they're nice. You know, they drive around, and I see them busting people and everything. I'm a pretty big guy, so I get that a lot, though.
So this, how do you remember how the drug transaction went south? Like, what happened? To, like, provoke him, or was it his own mental illness that provoked him?
It was induced by the drug, you know, the crystal meth, so.
Oh, my gosh.
As he was talking, and I'm not sure if it's obvious just by listening to his voice for all of you, but he seemed to kind of be edgy, jumpy. He kind of had this nervous demeanor, and as soon as he said meth, I noticed a couple of his bottom teeth were missing.
I got my own issues with paranoid schizophrenia from using the crystal meth. You feel superior when you first start doing it, and then everything goes south. I used to do ecstasy and cocaine, and then I was introduced to crystal meth, and then it just, I couldn't get enough of it.
Have you ever sought treatment for it?
I am in treatment, yeah. I've been to meetings and had a sponsor, and now I see a therapist.
That's great.
And I'm sober today. I haven't done it in a year or so.
Congratulations.
I never went to heroin. Thank God. That's the big one.
Mm-hmm.
I've experienced people that have overdone it, and, you know, you can go into a coma and not come ever back out.
So I had a recovering heroin addict in this car once, and we did an interview, and I had her describe what the feeling was like when you're on heroin, when you inject it, and she said it was like your blood was taking a bubble bath.
That's how they all explain. You get really warm.
Yeah, that's what she said. So I'm going to ask you the same question and see if you'll answer it. Is with crystal meth, when you tried it, you've done some other recreational drugs before, but what physically does it feel like? And mentally, how would you describe the feeling?
Well, I used to snort it, and most guys I know smoke it. And you get really... I just like cracky, like a dirty feeling when you smoke it. But I started injecting it, and you feel, I don't want to glorify it, but you feel superior. You feel like you can take on the world, and it's very euphoric. It's very euphoric, and it's an escape, and I chased that escape. And I can't believe, now looking back, I can't believe I used to shove needles in my arms, but I know a lot of people that do. It's a drinking town, and I know I'm a little jealous because I can't handle alcohol, but I'm a little jealous of the people that can drink every, you know, I know a lot of people that can drink every night and then go to work the next day and handle it. And they get their escape through drinking. And I know a lot of people that smoke marijuana too, and it, from what, you know, I don't really like it, but they get an escape through that too.
Mm-hmm.
And those are looked at very acceptable. And shooting Christmas is not looked at as acceptable. It's looked at as pretty pretty harsh. So,
but for good reason, right? Because it is more dangerous.
It is.
Well, yeah. I mean, alcohol is really dangerous because a lot of people drink it and then drive, and they can kill somebody or they can kill themselves. But would you say, as a as a recovering person that has tried it, that crystal meth deserves to be thought of as not acceptable because of the danger factor?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there was times where I had the flu or I was sick and, you know, I would find it and do it and feel better. It takes everything away. So, like...
How long? Like, you know, when you smoke a joint or something, it lasts for a couple of hours.
Yeah, the come down is really harsh.
How long does the high last?
For days. If you do a lot, yeah.
What if you just do one snort or whatever?
About 8 hours.
8 hours?
Yeah. That's why a lot of people, when they're cocaine addicts and they get introduced to crystal, they move over to crystal meth because it's a longer, stronger high than cocaine.
8 hours.
Yeah.
And can you, you said that you feel invincible. Can you be functioning during those 8 hours? Like, could you go out to dinner? Could you do your job? Like, or are you just too out of it?
Well, I used to work and in an office and just be snorting it and be functional. You don't eat. It takes all your appetite away. I was extremely thin. And then, I mean, you start injecting it and you can't function. You're just out of sorts.
So you could snort it on the job, but you can't inject it on the job.
Maybe some people do. I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did, but I was leaving, you know. I wouldn't be able to.
How long did your addiction to it last before you sought help and were able to pull away from it?
Oh, my appendix ruptured. And I saw it as part of... I was in the hospital for a month. And so I saw it as... That was the extreme use. Plus the paranoia. I couldn't handle it anymore.
So there was a flip side to the drug then. So it gave you euphoria. It gave you the feeling of invincibility that you could take on the world. But it also had a dark side where you got paranoid as well.
Oh, yeah. The police were after me. Aliens, ghosts, shadows on the floor. My screen crawling, neural net. They're listening to my thoughts. Everything science fiction came down on me from the extended use of the crystal.
How would you react mentally when you thought someone was monitoring your thoughts, a neural net? Your reaction?
I got myself into a lot of trouble. I'd be downtown yelling at people, and I'd be threatening people, and the police would come and talk to me, and sometimes I got taken in and questioned, and I would really be ranting and talking to myself, and I'd get my temper would go. I thought that they were, they knew who I was, and I thought that they could hear my thoughts, and yeah, it wasn't pretty. It was really scary. Lonely too. Lonely and scary.
Lonely too. What would you say, other than your appendix rupturing, but what would you describe would be the ultimate scary moment or situation that you found yourself in as a result?
Well, back then, hustling for the drug with men, and meeting them and having them pick me up and getting it and scoring, but then the door slams, you know, and it locks and you're stuck there, and you don't know where you are. I mean, I didn't know where I was. And I'm stuck there. What do I do? And fighting them off, and then getting arrested, of course, too. And Cook County is a scary place.
Yeah, Cook County jail, right? 26th and Cal?
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard that it's not a pleasant environment in there.
No, they don't treat you very well, and you could be next to murderers, and you're, you know, someone that just happened to get addicted to drugs and stole, you know, maybe forged a check, but, you know, you never hurt anyone. I never did physically come after anyone. I just verbally did. But you're standing next to, you know, convicted rapists, and they treat you all the same.
How long, or how many times did you get sent to Cook County, or was it just
once? Twice.
Twice, and then so how long before you posted bail were you in there each time?
2 weeks each time.
2 weeks each time before you posted. And what would you say was the scariest moment in Cook County for you personally?
The bullpens, they're the where you get registered. You're in there for a long time, and there's a lot of fights. A lot of people coming down off of heroin and angry that they're there, and you know, they start. Oh, a lot of fights. A lot of physical fights.
Did you ever... You were never involved in a physical fight?
I was, yeah.
What happened?
I got beat up pretty bad because they all ganged up on me, so... But I defended myself, but, you know... They kind of just... it's a lot going on, so... I don't like Cook County very much.
Right, so I'm guessing you're going to do whatever you can to avoid ever going back there.
I am. I have nothing to worry about as of today.
That's really great. I really commend you. It sounds like you're doing all the work you need to do.
Thank you.
To move on.
It just, you know, I didn't do drugs until I was 25 years old, and it just happens to fall in your lap. Like, I mean, in my lap, and hey, I've got some extra cocaine. Do you want it? I'm like, okay. Hey, this is crystal meth. You want to try it? I'm like, okay. If that didn't happen, it might have happened sometime later. But it was an introduction to the drugs, and I said yes. I didn't continue living my life not using drugs. So, I mean, it's my fault, but... It's strange how just a moment in time, like, drugs can fall into my lap, and then I, you know, I'm off and running.
We were almost to a near north suburb called Skokie, where his dentist appointment that morning was, and it was difficult to say, based on his body language, whether he was uncomfortable with telling his story, maybe he was craving another cigarette, he did smell really strongly of smoke, or if the conversation might have been a good distraction for him. I just couldn't tell, and it seemed like abuse of crystal may have an impact on people's motor skills. I just don't know. But with a couple minutes left in the car before we got to the dentist, I had him take me back to life before crystal meth.
Yeah, you were 25 when you were introduced to drugs. How old are you now?
I'm 45.
You're 45. And so where were you in life at age 25?
I was doing really well. I was working at a modeling agency in Beverly Hills. I was living in Hollywood, and I was trying stand-up comedy, and I was making good money. I worked as a bartender on the weekend, and I had good friends. I had a really nice apartment. I paid a lot for it, but it was my own, and you know, I would do, you know, the ecstasy came first. And, you know, I would just do it on the weekend. And then came the cocaine, and I was still all right. The crystal meth came.
In L.A.?
I used it in L.A., yeah.
Okay.
A lot yeah, as a Hollywood, everyone's doing drugs out there. I mean, everyone I knew. I mean, I worked as a waiter, and late night, the graveyard shift, and I used to get tipped in crystal meth. you know, from the drag queens. So it's a crazy town, but you know, I mean, it was everywhere. I'm not making excuses, but it was everywhere I went and I looked, and I could find it easily. And then I moved here because my family's here and I grew up here in Chicago, and it's not too hard to find here either. I mean, everyone I kind of ran into was either doing cocaine or crystal, so it kind of followed me, or I just put it out there and it came to me.
And so how long was the phase in your life where you had to resort to hustling, as you put it?
That was a few years.
My passenger says he has been clean for a year, and he goes to CA meetings, which is Cocaine Anonymous, goes to NA meetings, which is Narcotics Anonymous, and also CMA, which is Crystal Meth Anonymous. Goes to those meetings from time to time, but he added that he doesn't go as often as he probably should. Tough story to hear, but I hope it might serve as a cautionary tale for anyone out there right now who may be dabbling in harder drugs, possibly struggling with drug addiction right now. And I also wanted to share it because as someone who lives in a big city, you do see people on the street all the time. They're clearly drug addicts. A lot of them, most of them probably, are struggling with mental illness. And it's kind of easy to, on a day-to-day basis, like disregard them or ignore them. But you just never know what they've seen and what they've been through. And one of my big takeaways from my conversation with that passenger, you know, other than it being a cautionary tale, is this is a good person who made a bad mistake. And I really think it's important to hang on to that compassion for anyone who is dealing with addiction. I mean, I doubt there's anyone listening right now whose life hasn't been impacted in some way by drug or alcohol addiction, whether it's your own or somebody who is close to you. All right, coming up, I know it's been pretty heavy so far this episode, but we are going to completely shift gears and introduce you to another passenger I drove on that same Tuesday. The very different but equally compelling story, more specifically for her extremely niche career choice.
We can simulate that.
How about boobs?
Boobs come out. And it's a thing. It's a thing. Boobs and butts. Those are the two things that are usually seen all the time.
That woman's career involving sex that I never knew existed, and I'm pretty sure 99% of you have never heard of either, till this very enlightening car ride into the suburbs of Chicago. But before we get to that, two really quick housekeeping things. First of all, if you haven't joined up with us in the Backseat Rider community on Facebook, this is a place online where listeners of this show can chime in on our topics and share their own stories and perspectives. And I'm going to be sharing some stories from listeners over the course of the next few weeks here on the podcast. So stick around for that. And to find the group, all you have to do is search Facebook groups for Backseat Rider Community and request to join. Also, if you haven't signed up for Lyft yet, please be aware of my promo code. Listeners of this podcast can enter in the code Backseat Rider, all one word, when they sign up for Lyft, and you'll get $50 in free ride credit that way. Finally, to a sponsor that is helping make it possible for me to bring you this podcast for free, Geico. Everybody's got a to-do list, drop off the dry cleaning, pick up some milk. Well, here's an idea. Let's save hundreds of dollars on car insurance. And the good thing is you don't have to drop off or pick up anything. All you have to do is go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. Extra money in your pocket? It just may be the most rewarding to-do you do today.
Hey, podcast listener, this is Rob Cisternino. I'm the Rob, and Rob has a podcast, and the new season of Survivor is just getting started, and we've got new episodes for you 5 days a week. Join us for interviews with your favorite past Survivor players and this season's losers right after they get their torch snuffed. Listen free to Rob Has a Podcast, exclusively available on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the Podcast One app. And if you like the show, why not share it with a friend or leave us a rating and review on iTunes?
So often it seems that the car rides that almost don't happen at all end up being some of the most interesting. And later that day, at this point it was mid-afternoon, I did a drop-off pretty close to my house. So I was tempted to just turn off the Lyft app for the day, upload my interviews, and go grab my son from daycare. That is when a ride request, though, came in from the Andersonville neighborhood. It was female name. And once again, no profile picture popped up. But a few minutes later, I pulled up to a residential block, and a woman who appeared to be in her late 20s, possibly early 30s, hopped in the car. She was really friendly, and the first thing she said, she immediately apologized because she needed a ride to a far northern suburb. So that was going to be great if she was willing to do an interview. But if she wasn't willing to talk, it would probably wind up being about a two-hour time sacrifice for me. Now, like my other rides that day, I'd been exploring this topic of gun violence, and fortunately, she let me record on her perspective.
Well, to be honest, I have felt rather numb towards all of the shootings that have happened since Sandy Hook.
She gave a really thoughtful take on gun violence and her perspective following the shooting that happened a few weeks earlier in Florida. And you may hear that in a future episode of Backseat Rider, but it was her job that really made my ears perk up. As you guys know, I almost always ask what my passengers do for a living. And she answered by telling me she has a job called intimacy choreographer.
I have to say, you were the first intimacy choreographer that I've ever met, much less driven.
Yeah.
At first, I thought intimacy choreography was maybe a genre of modern dance that I just hadn't heard of. Turns out it is something way, way different. So buckle in.
What is intimacy choreography?
Intimacy choreography is staging any sort of intimate or sexual moment on stage. And my job really is to come in and make sure everyone is on the same page, is safe. I sort of facilitate and foster an ongoing conversation about consent that can be changed at any point throughout the run. And also just to get it out of the hands of two people who are navigating a sort of a delicate situation, so that there's a third party and that it's can be handled as a matter of business, as opposed to like, let's just feel it out. This really works for me, you know.
What is the danger of the let's just feel it out approach?
So I don't know if you're aware of. There was a theater in Chicago, Profiles Theater, where it has since been shut down. And it was because one of the artistic director who did a lot of the shows at the theater would often take advantage of his partners in scenes, in certain intimate scenes. And where, like, he would kiss them too long, or he would change the choreography, or there would be just essentially people were made to feel uncomfortable. And since there was a huge investigation that happened with the reader who broke the story, and from that, we now have Not in Our House, which is this fantastic group that advocates for safety practices within Chicago theaters, non-equity sectors. And so those rules sort of sort of came out of that, and I think we've seen a rise in intimacy choreographies since then.
Because before, your position
didn't really exist. Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the approach then, if I was an actor,
yeah,
and I had a sex scene, mm-hmm, or kissing makeout scene or, yeah, something like that, what would it feel like from my point of view? How would you approach me? What's the first step?
First step. So we come into the space. I think it's important to have sort of a sit-down conversation. And it's usually, writers are really good about explicitly putting in what you want from the scene. Sometimes they're not, though. So just like any time that you're working through a script, you kind of go through the beats of it, because at the end of the day, sex scenes aren't just there to be, like, tantalizing. They do hold emotional weight, and they do, hopefully, propel the story forward. So there's still certain sort of...
Narrative value.
Yes, exactly. So I come in, we talk about that. I have something called body mapping, which is just, like, a gender-neutral outline of a body. And green, you highlight green on the body parts that you're like, this is fine to be touched. Yellow is, let's have a conversation about it. And red is, absolutely not. And that can be any part of your body at any time. That can change at any point in time. And I don't need to know the circumstances. That is just, so we all have like a visual, sort of a visual contract that says, this is what we're going to adhere to. This is what we're going to respect with each other. And that's actually something I just recently incorporated into my practice. Because it, again, it's a new art form. And so I'm still sort of navigating it and figuring out how we can create that conversation around consent a little bit more. I personally think it's important to incorporate humor, and to acknowledge this is going to be awkward. You guys don't know each other very well. I don't know you at all. So like, your body is different than my body. And let's have a conversation about that. And like, within this context of this scene, how do you envision moving through the space? This is how I envision doing it. Great. Let's get up, knowing that we now have this trust and this form of consent with each other. And just sort of play around and like figure out what the bones of this piece looks like. And I don't push people a lot when we're figuring out those bones, which is just the framework. But then I'll come back in and finesse and add, like, little moments of, like, great. So, like, if you were to move their hair this way, if you take a breath here, specifically I was just doing a show over at Steppenwolf, You Got Older, and there's a scene where they lay down and make out, and we can't see what they're doing, but, like, we know they're making out. So I was like, can you slowly slide your leg up his leg? And that's where we're going to give the sensuality of that scene. So it's still sort of crafting and designing a moment like any other designer would, just in a far more sensitive nature.
So it's interesting. So I could see where it's almost like when a couple goes to counseling, mm-hmm, they put a lot of the, you know, marching orders in the hands of a third party, and,
yeah,
that really helps the couple, because then it's not like one of them deciding,
right,
and then the other reacting. So is,
exactly,
that kind of how it works, where,
yeah,
it's like, okay, you do the, are you comfortable, you'd be like, okay, would you be comfortable sliding your leg up in this way? And so it's your idea.
Yes. Rather than somebody just going for it and potentially making their partner feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. With everything that has been happening since Kevin Spacey / Harvey,
yeah,
Weinstein, is this new because of that, or was it coming up in that? And how has that whole scandal impacted your job?
Yeah. Well, so I've been doing this for about 4 years now. So it's always been an issue within the arts and just in general, quite honestly, where people have physically taken advantage of other people. But I've been doing it for about 4 years, and I think just in light of everything that's been coming on, I've been asked to work in the theaters more. There's more of a call for it now, and people actively trying to protect the people that they employ, as you should, as we all should try to protect and take care of one another. So I have been, whereas like,
you've been doing it way before Weinstein.
Yes. But it would be like maybe one or two shows a year. Now, within the past 3 months, I've worked on 3 shows.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, in Hollywood, with the major studios, is an intimacy choreographer standard, like a key grip? I mean, in the same way?
No, I don't know, actually. And I get the sense that it's not. My job is so specific to Chicago theater at the moment. And at some point, maybe I will expand that, but I love Chicago theater. I'm not sure, but I've had friends who have been on sets where they were like, they just told me to make it hotter. They just kept being like, make it hotter, make it sexier. And they were like, I don't know what that means. I don't know what it looks like.
I feel for them. Yeah. They're put in that position. Okay, so this question is going to be like, intimacy choreography 101.
Yeah.
Right? How far are actors expected to go, or what is your knowledge of how? I mean, I've seen, when I was in Amsterdam, I saw live sex on TV in a theater.
Right.
But that, I mean, that wasn't.
That's Amsterdam.
That's Amsterdam. Okay.
Uh huh. Yeah.
So how far it can be from making out to like what is the farthest it gets pushed? Because I know there's nudity on stage.
There is nudity on stage. Yeah, and I personally, I'm the biggest believer of, we don't need to see anything that removes us as an audience member to be nervous for the actor on stage.
That takes us out of the moment.
It really does. And I think it has a different place in film, because we're just naturally observant and removed in that way. But when you're in the theater, it's so intimate to begin with. And you don't know, as a performer or as a designer, what could be potentially triggering to someone in that audience. We can get across the point that we want to get across without ever having to like actually touch anyone's genitals at all. We can simulate that.
How about boobs?
Boobs come out, and it's a thing. It's a thing. Boobs and butts; those are the two things that are usually seen all the time. My big challenge right now is, as a Black feminist intimacy choreographer, to create scenes of sexual intimacy that are from my perspective and not from a learned patriarchal perspective.
Really different if the intimacy choreographer were like a 44-year-old white male CEO.
Exactly. Oh, let's just have a lot of boobs and so I'm all about, I think more, I don't know, and this is more a personal design element, but I like the hint of, I find, it's far more interesting to see the hint of something or the allusion to, as opposed to the full Monty.
My wife is a boudoir photographer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's her whole thing is like, and I think she's 100% right.
Yeah.
It's way sexier.
I mean,
if we're using that word, when you're left wondering.
Right.
You know, and it's
the
not,
art of the tease.
Yes,
it's,
exactly.
You know?
At this point, we are still driving on the Edens Expressway, which is a highway that extends from the north side of Chicago into the northern suburbs. And before I play this next section of our conversation, it does get pretty graphic. So once again, if kids or bosses are in an earshot, consider yourself warned. Also, there's a couple theaters in Chicago that are in the round. Okay, she uses that phrase. And to clarify for any non-theater people listening right now, a theater in the round just means instead of a stage at the front of the room and all the audience members facing that stage, in the round means that the stage is a circle and that the seats, the audience, they kind of form a perimeter around the stage, so everyone is facing toward the center.
What's the most awkward moment in that you've had as an intimacy choreographer? And then I'll ask the second part.
Most awkward. I don't know if it was the most awkward, but it was definitely the hardest. Was I had to stage a blowjob in the round, which, you know, that in a staging a blowjob is not hard. When you have audience on all sides and you don't actually want, is it okay if I say penis?
Yes.
You don't. Someone actually can't take their penis out. That's really hard.
How do you even stage a blowjob not in the round with no penis taken out?
It's just about distance and costumes. I work with. I try to have a dialogue with the wardrobe almost day one. Where, like, if someone has a shirt that's, like, unbuttoned and can be out and covers that person's face a bit as they're in position. Then, like, hand placement comes into effect. So we play with heights and where heads are at, and then arms and wardrobe.
And then you have a big wall in the back.
And then you have a big wall.
When you're lucky.
Yes. Where you're not like, oh, I don't see anything over there. Yeah.
However, when you're in the round...
I got none of that.
How did you navigate that? How did you stage oral sex in the round?
It's still my white whale. There were still like a couple of seats right behind them that I was like, you know, I'm just going to compromise my integrity for the safety of this actor. And they're not going to see anything. And they're going to know that they didn't see anything. And that's just what it is.
But for then the rest of the audience.
The rest of the audience got the full effect. And also, like, lighting comes into play with that. And distraction. distraction, deflect.
What's an example of that?
So the rest of the cast came out at one point and started doing spoken word poetry. So then people could focus on them as opposed to the action that was happening behind them, which was the blowjob. But I also... And we flipped it. So the people who were over here saw her head and then the rest of the audience saw his back. So I kept having to give the note, like, can you clench your butt just a little bit more? And, like, can you, like, sort of, like, feel your energy rise from, like, where your butt is clenched to, like, the back of your neck? And just, like, it's, you'd be amazed and just, like, articulating where you want people's energy to live, how easily you see that physically shift, and how that in and of itself tells a story. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Really?
And yeah.
No orgasm needed.
No. I mean, sometimes there is, though. Like, I just had to choreograph in You Got Older at Steppenwolf. It goes from this simulated sex scene to this cowboy sauntering off because you realize it's a fantasy and that it's just the girl by herself masturbating and having an orgasm. So we had to... That was actually probably our most awkward because it was like... We all had different ideas about what the orgasm should look like. And again, I was like, let's just... For this person who has to do this every night, it's whatever you want and whatever you feel comfortable with. And we got it. And again, like, lights, vocalization, and wardrobe really saved us on that.
It's so interesting.
Yeah.
And then the second part is, what choreographed intimate scene have you been most proud of in the last 4 years, would you say? That you just felt, man, we hit it out of the park on that. Like, the audience felt it. The actors were comfortable. Home run.
I did a show with Route 66 where it's these two people. I think it's just because it was so absurd, but it was still sexy. These two people whose mothers are in the oncology unit at a hospital and, like, you know, passed out in their beds. And these two people are crying because they're concerned about their mothers. And then they take, like, solace in each other. and they have this huge, like, sort of raucous sex scene that goes from, like, the chair to the bathroom in this hospital room.
Wow.
And at one point, like, the guy sits on a squatty potty and, like, goes down on the girl. And it was just, it was a 3-minute sex scene, which is so long on stage.
Yeah.
It's so long. But it ended up, it was funny, it was humorous, and it was sexy and, like, sad all at the same time. So I was like, yeah, we did that.
At this point, we had pulled up to the theater where she was about to work on choreography for yet another intimate scene on stage. And before she got out, she left me with a thought that stuck with me on who would be qualified to do her job effectively. And more specifically, consider this. Could a man be an effective intimacy choreographer?
We're so trained to appease what men want. Like, that's what we're taught from, like, the earliest age, and especially going into, like, our sexual identities. So when you have that dynamic shift of, like, a male choreographer telling you this is what they want, I think it's hard to unlearn those sort of societal teachings, or even to, like, have the courage to push against it. Or we see the opposite end of the spectrum where it's, fuck that, I'm not doing that. And I don't feel comfortable. I don't want to listen to you. In the same way that, like, when I teach fight choreography, a lot of men get really upset with me. Or not even upset, but they're just like, I know how to fight more than you do. Mm. I'm like, yeah, but I've also had 4 years of training, so maybe you don't. Mm-hmm. So I guess, like, the conversation is open for everyone to be a part of it, but I think it takes, again, for specific scenes, an understanding of women's sexuality.
Yeah.
In order to really do the job to its fullest.
Okay, that is where I'm going to leave it this week. But before I get going, I would love to continue today's conversations with all of you online. What'd you guys think of this week's passengers? What parts of their stories struck you the most? I'm going to be starting a discussion thread for this episode in the Backseat Rider community on Facebook. All you have to do is search Facebook groups for Backseat Rider community and request to join. Also, iPhone users, don't forget, if you didn't at the beginning of the episode, to please leave Backseat Rider a review on the iTunes app, the Apple Podcasts app. As long as you got it open, it'll only take you a few seconds and it'll really help me out and help this show reach more and more people. Also, before I go, one last reminder that Lyft, it's not a sponsor of this show, has zero to do with the content we cover. But if you haven't signed up for Lyft yet and want to help me out and support the podcast as well, please sign up for Lyft using my promo code BackseatRider, all one word. That is good for new users of the Lyft app, and also $50 in free ride credit for you. Backseat Rider is edited by Bob Gilmartin. And also thank you so much to WTTW and WTTW.com for their support of this podcast. Look for new episodes of Backseat Rider every Wednesday at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app. And if you have an iPhone, make sure you are subscribed on Apple Podcasts.